Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for the best short story by Jack London. To help me are two Americans, my friends, Ian and Joe, two English teachers. This is confusing. It's getting intercontinental.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm Joe Holshue. I am an American English teacher. Joe America, some people call me. And I am reading, oh boy, if you're waiting for Intercontinental, I am reading a short story called The Mexican this week by Jack London, read by Joe Holshue, the American English teacher.
This is very confusing.
I hope our lit heads are keeping up.
Oh, taking
I
notes.
Think we need a like one of those very serious spoiler warnings, or not spoiler, but like warnings before the episode. It's like, dear lit heads, I hope you're listening carefully. We encourage you to take a pen and a pad of paper and keep track of which country people are from, because it gets very confusing right here in the first few minutes.
Now, why is it a British person?
Well, it was kind of started off British, but then it turned into something worse and more creepy.
So. It was kind of Ronald Reagan-y there toward the middle. Like,
yeah, it was a little Mr. Burns meets Ronald Reagan.
Listen, there's a reason. There's a reason I'm an English teacher and not an actor on Broadway.
Yeah, that was it.
That is the reason right there. The one reason.
Hello. Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. My name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. I'm studiously cutting my ties with Jack London, but I live closer to his burned down ranch than any of you guys. Today I brought his short story, To Build a Fire, which is probably his best.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
I like how we've done like 25 of these episodes now, and I think we get worse at the intro every single week. Like, I think our best intros are our early ones.
I disagree. I think we're getting much better at the intro.
This is the heart of deconstruction. Mm. The deconstructive move is to say, listen, we'll establish the convention and then we'll subvert it.
Well, I'll cut right to it. I don't know who Jack London is at all. So
thank
when
you
guys said
that's
to me
the honesty
you
that litheads should show up for
two short stories, I got excited because we've done a lot of books, a lot of classics.
We've done a lot of long stories.
Well, I know how Dracula ends. I know how.
Name one other book that we've done the podcast, Nick.
I know how other books end. So when you guys said Jack London, I got pretty excited because I really don't know anything about this guy.
Yeah, Jack London's he's an exciting guy to not know much about. That sounds weird. That sounds like I'm slighting
him. It does sound pretty weird.
Yeah, no.
It sounds like Nick should be glad he doesn't know anything about this guy.
Yeah. Well, Nick, do you remember our Ernest Hemingway, our Hemingsode? Ernest Hemingway was kind of, in a lot of ways, he was more famous for the life he lived than the books he wrote. I don't know if I can back that up, but he was also very famous for
just
the life he lived.
Just stick with it. Keep going.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to suggest something to bring back something, a feature that you did, what feels like several lifetimes ago. It's called the KWL. And I think it might be a good idea to do this for Jack London, for our good friend Nick over here, and just see what he knows about Jack London, what he wants to know about Jack London, and then later we'll check in.
Litheads, you brought your pencils. If you would like to do the KWL along with us, you will need three columns on the sheet in front of you. One has K at the top, the second W, and the third L. And they, of course, stand for what do you know, Nick and Litheads, about Jack London? What do you want to know? And then as a post-assessment, we would say, what did you learn about Jack London?
This is not going to go how you want. I don't know anything about him.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do.
I know
you
his know name. A few I things. Know he's a man, an international man.
Yep.
I knew he was born in London. London is a nickname.
Really good things.
A pseudonym. It's got to be a pseudonym, right?
It is. His real name is Jack Paris.
Okay.
So Ian, just to give you a glimpse into my teaching life, I tend not to tease the students when they tell me what they know.
Oh, you know what? I see the pedagogical value of that, and I will take that note to heart.
No, I don't. He wrote Call of the Wild.
Oh, that's really good.
Oh, he did.
He nice also job. Wrote. He also wrote White Fang, didn't he, Ian?
Right.
Yep. And he's dead, right?
Ooh, oh, sure yeah. is.
Quite a while.
Super dead? For quite a while. Okay.
Super dead.
Okay, so those are the things that I know.
Nick, I gave you a clue in my introduction. I said I live closer to where his burned out ranch is than any of the rest of you.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Yes. He had a ranch at one point in his life.
That was somewhere in the proximity of Ian's house.
I'm glad we went back and covered that. Well, welcome everybody to You Don't Know Lit, where every week we pit two books against each other in a bloody book battle. Where
there's blood?
There's blood, there's books.
Oh, no.
And
guys,
everybody...
I have not been cleaning up the blood. Where does that blood go? And what does book blood look like?
It's just like regular blood. I just also wanted to share some rules with you guys. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And rule number three, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. And listening back on some past episodes, I think I may have to start enforcing these rules.
Oh, no.
I think if you break these rules, you lose. I think there needs to be some consequences. I'm looking at rule number one about unavoidable spoilers, and I don't think we're really following these.
Some spoilers.
And Joe, if you talk too much, you lose.
So my strategy needs to just be keep Joe going.
Tell us more.
What else do you think?
Well, dang. I got some spoilers today. I am sorry, but I need spoilers.
I'm going to wreck this shit.
And I will be telling you nothing about my story.
Joe, why don't you give me your 30-second plot?
All right. The Mexican, Nick, written in 1911, comes to you in three parts. The first is a blood-stirring tale of the Mexican Revolution. The third is a knockdown, drag-out, winner-take-all boxing match. Did I miss the second? It's an extended contract negotiation, but it's by far the most riveting contract negotiation I've ever read. It's a one-hour audiobook, Nick, and the Mexican is Ernest Hemingway before there was Ernest Hemingway.
Okay, great. Thanks. Excited to hear more about that contract.
Joe, you really know how to draw us in.
You know, have you witnessed a lot of contract negotiations?
It's so, you know, point. One time I once heard a writer say that novel writing is just real life with the boring parts taken out. So
it's Hitchcock, but yeah.
Yeah. Got it. A famous writer.
The famous writer, Alfred Hitchcock.
So normally, no. Most writers would leave out the contract negotiations, but Jack London is not most writers. He left it in. And it's pretty good.
It's an international man.
You keep saying international man like it's a thing. Are you trying to set up like international man of mystery? Is that what's going on? Is this an Austin Powers
Jack
deal?
London, it sounds like he's either a murderer or some sort of like James Bond type character.
Well, it does. It like evokes Jack the Ripper, like Jack the Ripper, London murderer.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
Yeah,
that was in London, wasn't it? Yeah. Or it was by Ian's house, either one of those.
it was closer to Ian's house than it was to your house, Matt.
I keep telling you guys I live in Nevada, but I actually live in England.
Ian, speaking of England, why don't you give me your 30-second plot?
Segways. In Jack London's story To Build a Fire, a greenhorn in the Yukon Territory sets out to walk cross-country with his dog in 75 below weather. He falls into some water and gets wet. In order to avoid freezing, he has to build a fire. Does he succeed? Does he fail? The dog survives.
So, litheads, all three of us are from Wisconsin, and we do know a little about the cold. And just in case you're from warmer climates, if you fall in water when it's 75 degrees below zero, it's pretty dangerous. Like
yes, it is.
It's pretty dangerous.
Yes, it is.
Of course, only people from Wisconsin know that.
No, that's yes, obviously.
Once you cross over into Minnesota, it's completely different rules.
Completely different. The gravity shifts, and it's just
wild
over there.
Guys, I'm sorry. I found out a really interesting word fact, and I want to share it with you, if that's okay, before we get to figuring out who goes first. Thank you. I was thinking about the word temperature.
Mm,
because like we talk about like it's like
four seconds ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been thinking about it for the last probably now, it's about 7 seconds. Since I was preparing this, as I prepared my case for today, I was thinking about this word, and so I decided to look it up because it has this root, temperate. Mm-hmm. And we talk about like, oh, the weather there is temperate, and we might use this to refer to a person, like they are a very temperate person, not kind of extreme, not radical. And so I decided to dig into this, and it turns out the original meaning of the English word temperature was equally balanced and properly proportioned. So you would use the word temperature to refer to somebody's quality of being chill.
Yeah.
So you would say, oh, I really respect so-and-so. His temperature is so peaceful.
Yeah.
And then it's only after Galileo in the 1670s that it takes on this meaning of how many degrees of heat or cold. And that's like that's all we use it for. We wouldn't say like, I admire the temperature of that person's character. That's more or less gibberish.
What did they call the weather back then?
I don't think they talked about the weather. It was just always cold. Have you never seen a movie about the Middle Ages?
What was small talk like?
Ian, every once in a while, I talk to my students about an idea sort of like this. Like I'll talk about word roots or origins or like just something linguistically that I think is interesting. And universally, my students hate it. Like universally, my students do not care about it. I think it's fascinating. Right.
And now you can freak out your spouse and possibly even your child by referring positively to their temperature. And they'll think you're talking about like they're feeling chilly and they need a blanket. And you'll be like, nope, I was being old and smart.
Mm-hmm.
So eat it.
Joe, I'd like to hear from you now. If you'd like to go first. Joe, tell us about,
I read a short story this week called The Mexican, written by Jack London. A little bit of background in the plot here, a little bit about The Mexican.
Is Brad Pitt in this?
Yeah, no, different movie, but I was hopeful that there was something made of it, but I do not believe there has been. The Mexican, as I said, comes to you in three parts. Just a brief overview of the plot. It is set during the Mexican Revolution, and in the United States, there's these kind of pockets of revolutionaries, like pockets of rebels that are fighting or raising money for or somehow supporting the Revolutionary War. One day, this young guy shows up wanting to help the revolution, and everybody's super distrustful of him right away. So they start giving him menial jobs around the place. They say, well, if you want to help the revolution, you can mop the floor. If you want to help the revolution, you can like put stamps on these envelopes.
I love that.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
If you'd like to help the revolution, you're going to have to clean my shoes.
Yep.
We should start telling our children and assorted family members that.
If you want to help the revolution.
Yes.
Take out the trash.
Take out the trash.
But this guy, this young guy that they're suspicious of, and when I say young guy, I mean maybe like 19 years old, this young guy that they're suspicious of, he kind of uncomplainingly does all of these tasks in order to help the revolution. And his mantra is it for the revolution? Then I'll do it. And he mops the floor. Is it for the revolution? Nice. Then I'll do it. And he licks stamps to put on envelopes, doing this clerical work, basically.
I thought you were going to say he licked the floor, and I was concerned about that, because that's kind of abusive.
Mm-hmm. As it goes on, it becomes kind of quickly apparent that this young guy is an amateur boxer, although most of his bouts are taking place off the page. Most of the time on the page is focused on the revolution. And the climax of this is when the young man gets in a boxing match for $5,000. The winner takes $5,000. He enters into a winner-take-all boxing match because the revolution needs money for guns. And that is the story.
So I bet there's a theme going on here. What's the overt message here? What's the real story?
Like, what's the thing that your English teacher is going to be very disappointed if you don't pick up on?
That you didn't pick up on. Yeah. Like, every short story has an overt message. What's the real story here, Joe?
Yeah. So, as the litheads know, English is just a matter of strapping short stories to a chair and torturing them for their information.
Who do you work for?
And this, I do have some thoughts about the message of this, but I think in order to understand the message, like so often happens, Ian, we have to understand some background about Jack London. Yes. In a segment that I like to call, not to get too portmanteau, but I like to call it Facts London.
Yeah, you do.
Are we just going to put facts in no matter the author's name?
Maybe it's, I think it's the S that ruins it. Fact London. What about Fact London?
That's shit.
I like Facts London, and I strongly approve of wrestling various authors' names to include the word fact. This is, if this is our contribution to history, then so be it.
All right, I flipped. I'm in.
Okay, so I've got a whole bunch of these. I just went through and I highlighted, like, I think the most interesting ones.
You mean the most interesting fact Londons?
The most interesting fact Londons. He was Jack London. This is was not born as Jack London. He
just
was
tell me his as, fucking name.
He was born as John something else, but his last name is not a pen name. His mother actually married a man named John London, and Jack, young Jack, assumed his last name. So Jack London,
I did not know that,
is not a pseudonym. It is just his real, really cool name. His dad, his birth father, was an itinerant astronomer, which is something that I didn't know you could be, like a wandering astronomer.
What year was it?
This is he wrote The Mexican in 1911. I think he was born in 1875, 1876, something like that.
If you're an astronomer in the 1800s, are you just like a hobo?
Look at the stars!
Yeah, are you just a crazy person? Like, what are you doing? Like, what's the day to day?
Well, and the fact that he was an itinerant astronomer makes me feel like he was like a freelance astronomer, like like going door
to
door.
He wasn't under contract, hence the deep love for contract negotiations.
There we go.
There it is. Full circle. Right.
I've got a bunch more of these. When he turned 14 years old, he went and he bought a sloop, a small sailing ship named the Razzle Dazzle.
That's a great name for a boat. Great name.
He bought it from an oyster pirate, which is a thing that I learned about when I read this. And he taught himself not only
you
to
just
sail.
Spitting off just some crazy shit.
He not only taught himself to sail in San Francisco Bay, but he also became an oyster pirate and would go around and steal oysters from people's traps in his sloop named the Razzle Dazzle.
Was he independently wealthy or something? Like, was this person just loaded?
No. In fact, he was born pretty poor. He was very working class and would really kind of celebrate the working class throughout his work. Like, he really identified with the poor and the working. At 17 years old, he joined a seal hunting crew up in the Bering Strait. When he came home, he became a vagabond. He would travel the railroads with hobos walking and jumping trains.
This is way better than Hemingway.
I disagree. Hemingway shot sharks with a machine gun. What more do you want?
He headbutted his way out of a crashed airplane.
it's at least on par with Hemingway. It's kind of wild. Keep going, Joe.
It's pretty wild. When he was done vagabonding, he came back and went to the Klondike, where he went to make his fortune during the gold rush there.
Inventing the Klondike bar.
Mm-hmm. He went to the Klondike. He worked as a gold prospector there, and he returned back to California with $4.50 worth of gold and scurvy.
Wait. Was it $4.50 worth of scurvy too?
That's a good question. He returned with scurvy and also $4.50 worth of gold. He decided that he now had something to write about, which is, of course, the suggestion to all aspiring writers is go out, get married, get divorced, get scurvy, right? And get something to write about. He decided he had something to write about, but I don't know how good he was at it yet, because over the next 6 months, he received 44 rejections for short stories that he tried to publish about his time in the Klondike.
Let's just pause here and tell the litheads, if you've gotten 44 rejections, it's all good. That doesn't mean you're a bad writer. Just be calm, hang out. Eventually you'll get an acceptance.
Let's also give this advice to gamblers. If you are down 40, if you've lost 44 times in a row, just get back on that chair, and maybe that next time it'll all be worth it.
Maybe.
I think there's some good advice there because his 45th submission was to the Atlantic, I want to say, which is, of course, like a bigwig in the literary world, both then and now. And it was accepted. And he basically never looked back at that point. He was incredibly prolific.
Because of the scurvy? Or
he couldn't turn his head.
He couldn't physically look
back. Okay. So... He was super prolific. He wrote 1,000 words a day every day. Like he woke up, wrote 1,000 words, and then moved on with his day. I read an article that said he had published over 20 works or something like that, which is like quite a bit. But I went to his Wikipedia page and I counted what he had actually published. He published, hold on to it, 23 novels, 3 memoirs, 22 nonfiction essays, 3 plays, 45 poems, and 119 short stories in his lifetime.
Wow. And he lived to be like 102, right, Joe?
Yeah, it was like 102 if you divide it by like, oh, I don't know, 2.5. He lived to be 40 years old.
Well, this isn't a math. Okay,
it's the most awkward way of saying
not a math. He did podcast here. Let's just say how old he was when he died. 42. So that fucker published everything, huh? Those are all published, not written.
He was just published. Those are all published. He was 40 years old when he died, and he had published just a whole bunch.
So what have you done with your life?
Oh God, it's a very stressful question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, I have to wrap this up because I have things to talk about with like the actual short story.
Yeah, you should actually talk about your book, bud. I guess he kind of did. Keep going, though. These are fascinating.
Yeah. He didn't believe in marrying for love. He wanted to marry for rational reasons and to, quote, produce healthy Anglo-Saxon boys and girls to prove that love is an illusion. Oh, no.
Oh, it's unavoidable, isn't it? You just have to get to the eventual racism.
12 minutes into my time, and we're on to the racist stuff.
okay.
So he married for practical reasons. He said...
To grow the white race. Mm-hmm.
He said, quote, I made up my mind. Sunday evening, I opened the transactions for a wife. By Monday evening, the affair was well underway, and next Saturday morning, I shall marry Bessie May. And he did marry her. They had a couple of daughters. He cheated on her a whole bunch. He left her at a certain point, married a second wife for love this time. And I think that's all the bio I'm going to talk about for Jack London.
What we didn't touch on is also his blatant disrespect for women.
Not only... I actually might have some things to say about racism. I think he was... basically, my Cliff Notes version of racism here is, was he a racist? Checkbox. Yeah, was he a racist? Not really for the time. Like, he was actually kind of progressive for the time. So
He was big into eugenics.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, like, not racist for the time is, like, still really racist. Like, the bar is so low. So tell me more about the book, because I already forgot about... I forgot about everything that you said that the book was
about. I
have
a question about the book.
Yep, go for it.
This is a key question, which is going to... You guys don't know this, but I kind of keep a running tally of whether Joe wins or whether I win. And unsurprisingly, I've won every single episode in my mind so far. So, Joe, this is going to be important for whether or not you win this week in my mind. Mm-hmm. Does anyone in this story about the Mexican Revolution say... Viva la revolucion.
Oh, that's so good. So I feel like if I say no, I'm going to lose this week. So
is this a trap? Is this a spoilers trap?
No, it's not a spoilers trap. No, nobody says viva la revolucion.
Do they suggest it? Do they suggest it?
Oh, well, they suggest it in so much as you can suggest it while like mopping floors and licking stamps. Like, this is very much the clerical side of the revolution that we're looking at. Okay. So
just to pause here, Joe, you gave us the brief overview of what the book is about, saying this guy does everything for the revolution. Mm-hmm. You gave us this full background about this guy, but I'm still not saying the connection here.
Yeah. Let's talk. Let's talk about the revolution just for a second. I guess the last thing that you need to know about Jack London is, and this actually connects to his like quasi-racism stuff, is Jack London was an avowed socialist. Like he ran for the mayor of Oakland under the socialist ticket twice. Okay. He, when he was vagabonding around America, he was joining like workers' protests. He has a long poem that he wrote called Ode to a Scab, in which he basically just lambasts strikebreakers, right? Scabs, people that crossed picket lines. He was an avowed and engaged socialist the entire time, his entire life.
Okay.
So what does that have to do with revolution?
I think I see there might be a connection. Keep going.
It has a few things that I really like about it. The first one is, of course, that it is about revolution. It is set during the very early years of the Mexican Revolution. It's written in 1911, published in 1911. The Mexican Revolution started in like 1910 and went until like 1819, something like that. So Jack London's on top of this pretty quickly. It's set inside this ragtag camp of revolutionaries trying to scratch together enough people and funds.
1924.
Is when it ended.
Yep.
Perfect. And this is written in 1911. So like early days. Setting aside this camp, people just basically trying to scratch enough money and funds and people together to really support the revolution in any way that they can. It is really this story about not only like these revolutionaries, but ultimately Rivera, which is the title of our main character, the name of our main character, of him being this little guy against overwhelming odds. Rivera's sneaking out at night, and he sneaks out sometimes at night. Sometimes he disappears for a week. Sometimes he disappears for a month, and he keeps coming back with bruises and scrapes and injuries, but with like money for the revolution. Right. So he goes out, okay. he comes back with all these scrapes and bruises and has money to contribute to whatever kind of petty needs the revolution has at this moment. Over the course, pretty quickly in the novel, it becomes clear that Rivera, this very silent, very stoic guy, is sneaking away and getting in boxing matches. And he's a pretty talented young boxer. When the revolution needs guns, they need about $5,000 for guns. Rivera says, I've got it. Like, I can take care of this. And he leaves and finds himself a title fight, like a title bout.
How is he such a passive boxer? Does he not know he's a really good boxer? Does somebody just become accidentally good at being at boxing? Am I thinking too much about this?
No, I don't think you're thinking too much about it. They kind of talk about Rivera being, I kind of picture him like Brad Pitt in Fight Club, you know, like that really like kind of scrawny, sinewy, but like toughness.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. They talk about him like his boxing.
He's a scrappy guy.
That's exactly it, right? And okay. In a lot of ways, like he's a guy whose talent is being able to go for 15 rounds. He's a guy whose talent is being able to take a punch, right? And like hanging in it until he has the opportunity to, you know, lay the other guy out.
Wait. Is there some kind of like connection between his boxing, his endurance as a boxer, and his endurance through the licking of the floor and the mopping of the stamps?
So really good stuff. I think Ian gets a gold star for English class today.
Is there a connection? Hold on. I have a connection too. Is there some sort of connection between his role in Fight Club and Brad Pitt playing the movie in The Mexican?
Also a fantastic connection, Nick. We'll put it on the board. You know, okay. English teachers or teachers do this thing where we never tell students no.
We'll put it on the board.
let's write it on the board. It's on the board. Good job, Nick.
Nick is on the board, baby. Thanks, teach. So the author's fascinating. The book sounds pretty interesting. Why is this book worth reading? Why do you like it? Why should I like it?
More importantly. The very last thing I would say here, in case we didn't pick this up, this is the point where we have to like spell it out for our students here. One of the things that's interesting about this book is it can be read, and it very well might be, this parable for socialism. When Diaz goes into this title fight, he's fighting this guy who is all manner a better boxer than him. He's like big and strong. He's got this like rippling physique. He's social. People like
he's capitalism.
Like him a lot. He's capitalism. That's it. His name okay. is Danny. He's capitalism. And he's really kind of a dick to Rivera. Like he's super mean to him. And there's a really cool scene in the contract negotiation where they're talking about the split. Right? They're talking about okay. the split for...
Is that what this is? Okay, cool.
Yeah, so they're talking about the split for the fight, right? And Danny says, well, of course, I'm going to get 80% of the gate and you're going to get 20% of the gate because I'm the star. I'm the draw. And Rivera does the math and he says, well, how much is that going to be? And he tells him, oh, it'll be like a couple thousand dollars. Like, you'll make a couple thousand dollars. And Rivera says, well, that's not enough. I need $5,000. And Danny tells him, well, tough. Like, that's too bad. You're not going to get $5,000. So Rivera is the one that proposes, let's make it winner take all, right? Like, let's make this fight winner take all, which, if you are Rivera, is a crazy thing to propose because you're fighting the champ here, right? And as when he's in the fight, when he's in this fight, there's all sorts of odds stacked against him. Like the ref is actively pulling for Danny. Everybody has bet money on Danny, including the people in Rivera's corner. Like the odds are stacked against Rivera. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I guess I don't know how much more to say here without getting to unavoidable spoiler territory.
I think we're deep in it. You don't have to tell us who wins the fight. I think we get it.
So it's just there, this cool.
Is it?
Like,
is it? Hey, Joe, is it a good yep. book or not really?
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's a quick listen. It's also like one of the things that I think is cool about The Mexican is it's kind of a deep cut. Like it seems like not that many people Ooh. Have read it. It still exists. It still kicks around. There's a little bit of like people talking about it online, but for the most part, like it's not a Jack London story that is widely circulated anymore. And I think it's cool just for that. It gives you a glimpse into a different time and place and different problems. And it's still, I guess the thing I haven't said yet, which is probably Jack London's best thing, which is like, it's still just really well written and a cool little adventure story and a lot of fun to read.
So if I was a cool kid, this is the book.
Yeah.
This is the book for me.
Right. This is the one that like nobody's heard of, but you're like, people are like, what's your favorite Jack London? Oh, you wouldn't know it.
Yeah, you probably haven't heard of it.
This is like the Fallout Boy of books.
Yeah. I think I'm going to get a t-shirt, like an old t-shirt that says The Mexican on it.
Huh? Don't do that.
here's my question.
Yep.
Is or is not Rocky IV based on this story?
Okay. Is Rocky IV the one with the Russian?
Yes.
It's probably the closest that a movie comes to being this story. Is there a contract negotiation in Rocky IV?
Oh, yeah. Famous contract negotiation scene.
What is that? What's the Russian
name? Half of it's
that?
In English and the other half is in Russian and they kind of just don't understand each other.
They kind of play it for laughs, but it's really deeply tense if you know Russian.
Well, it's frustrating. It's frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Ivan Drago is basically Danny from right. the Mexican.
That's what came to mind immediately. Like,
yeah. So yeah, Nick, you should read this book because it's pretty much Rocky IV.
Sweet. oh, hang on. Is one of the chores that they give him punching meat.
Oh, punching meat. That would be so good.
For the revolution.
Whap. Whap. There's another.
That's my Rocky.
That's really good. Sylvester Incredible. Stallone.
Thank you, guys.
This week we're alienating Sylvester Stallone.
Did you know there was a musical based on Rocky?
I bet it's awesome.
I don't know. I'm going down the rabbit hole right now.
I mean, do you have more information? Because we'd like it.
Let's see. Critical reception. Oh, positive reviews from critics. Yeah. It's does not have Eye of the Tiger. No, it does have Eye of the Tiger. Yeah. Sorry. Yep. It's got Eye of the Tiger in it, which is, I think that's all I need to know about
it.
It'd
be a real miss if it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing a musical based on Rocky, you basically have one job. By the way,
what songs are we going to put in this? Like, I can't think of any. Yeah, we know Rocky could work on the stage. We know it could be a musical, but we need a score. What songs?
take a moment of silence.
You know what? The fact that you're cackling grimly throughout this moment of silence really robs it of any sort of memorial grandeur.
It's just hard not to laugh. I don't know why. Hey, guys, we lost a lot of good ones this year. I mean, I can't do this seriously.
No, that's
true. Serious version?
Can we get the music from the Oscars where they always have like the in memoriam thing?
It's so fucking sad. And then the people that you are sad that died, like they don't give them long enough.
No.
Right.
Because they have to get everybody on there. Like equal time.
Like the audio mixer is like getting the same screen time as is Sean Connery.
Okay, so wait. Nick, I'm confused.
Yeah.
Would you prefer that Sean Connery got more or that the mixer got more because you're a fan of mixing because you're an audio engineer for this podcast?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, it's a great question, Ian. It's a great question.
Thank you.
I think that the people that we care more about should get more time. And the people that we don't care about should get less time.
And just to pin you down here, do you care more about the mixer or about Sean Connery?
It depends how you look at it. It depends how you look at it, Ian.
I look at it and I say, we lost a lot of great ones this year.
Hey, you know what I noticed about some of the dead people this year is that they all had wonderfully reviewed memoirs. I thought maybe you guys can read those and tell me which celebrity was superior.
Are we doing this is head to head, right?
This or is head to head. I want you guys to tell me about the best celebrity memoir. Memoir.
I have a memoir, Nick, from a recently deceased celebrity and a celebrity. You know how people say like, oh, that celebrity really feels like they were part of my life. They feel like they were my friend and I'm sad that they died.
Yes.
I've always thought that was like total BS, right? But when Alex Trebek died earlier this year, it made me genuinely a little bit sad. Like Alex Trebek has been a part of my life since third grade. So I plan on reading Alex Trebek's recently released memoir called The Answer Is Reflections on My Life.
I would like, so listen, I thought about doing the probably award-winning memoir of Chadwick Boseman, who tragically passed away from cancer.
Does he have a memoir?
Probably, I don't know. And then I thought about doing the probably awesome memoir, if it exists, of Ruth Bader Ginsburg,
who
also passed away. I realized about two-thirds of the way into her name that I did not know how to pronounce her last name, whether it was a soft G or a hard G.
There's a serious lack of respect going on here for our dead. I just want to just underscore that.
Litheads, we do say all of this with love. Like all of our...
Of course.
Everything with love.
But I decided to instead focus on the one that Nick mentioned previously, the dead celebrity, Sean Connery. And I'm going to bring his very, very long memoir, Being a Scot. It should be good. And it's also
it
long.
It should be, so. Or it is.
I mean, it's been well reviewed. I haven't read it yet. I'll read it between now and next week. It might be great. It might not. This is the risk we take.
It's the risk. Sometimes we read horrible 900-page long books.
That's why they call it literature.
That's why they call it lit.
All right. Ian, I hear really good things about your book. Joe says it's actually the best book Jack London's ever written. So I'm excited to hear more about it.
Okay. So I don't have much to say about Jack London besides the fact that, well, I do have two things. The first is that he went to Berkeley, like the University of California, Berkeley, the gem of the UC system. He really wanted to go to Berkeley and he dropped out. And it's just, I bring this up because I'm kind of freaked out by how many of our authors for this show have dropped out of college. Like so many of them. It's really, really odd. Maybe we're just hitting a run.
Is it?
Ah.
Don't most successful people drop out of college? Not like the really successful ones. I mean like the superficial, like celebrity successful ones.
We haven't found a lot of successful ones who went to college and got their 4-year degree in like business and then
business marketing and then wrote
and then wrote the Great American Novel. It's all these dramas. I don't know.
Dick. Yeah.
I don't know. It's just kind of strange. So that's
how does that make you feel as a teacher? Pretty confused, I bet.
Between Ian and I, we probably have something like 25 years of like post-secondary education.
I think you're not wrong. Disgusting. So that's one interesting thing about Jack London. And he also he was also a member. I wanted to bring this up. It really doesn't affect my story that much at all, but it's really, really interesting, and I wanted to tell you guys about it. Have you ever heard of something called the Bohemian Club?
Sounds cool.
Nope. It does sound cool and exclusive.
Depends. Yeah, it is very exclusive. It depends on who you ask. So Richard Nixon thought it was ridiculous. He has a quote, which I won't read on air, but it's pretty dreadful, about what he thought about it. So this is a club, a men's only club in Northern California. And usually when we say like gentleman's club, that means like a strip club. This mm-hmm. is the gentleman's club, which is like the old fashioned kind where it's like they fight hard in the courts to keep women from being near it.
Yeah.
And they
instead
own
of like women being objectified physically, they just probably just
ban them.
them all together.
In neither kind of club.
It's a no girls allowed club.
Are women integrated as equals?
I'm picturing overstuffed armchairs and snifters of cognac.
Oh, yeah. Well, the crazy thing about the Bohemian Club is it has boasted some really, really powerful, influential members. So Nixon was a member, Reagan was a member, George H.W. Bush was a member.
Do you want to do your Reagan impression? Is that long-winded? Just to bring Reagan back up again?
No, I refuse. Oh, my goodness. What a mess that was.
Bring up my favorite club.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Henry Kissinger, Newt Gingrich, a bunch of others. So this is like kind of the Bohemian Club is a group of guys who they date back to the 1880s. They've had new members since then. They're not vampires, but they kind of were. It's like the literal iteration of a good old boys club.
Yeah,
like this is the good old boys club, and they own this grove of redwood trees in Northern California, where they have these yearly gatherings, they're called the Hijinks. And every summer, they go out there for a 2-week camping trip where they drink and they eat and they watch plays. They have this opening ceremony, which involves burning an effigy of stress in the middle of a lake. So they have like a physical embodiment of stress, and they push it out into the middle of the lake and they light it on fire and like, look, you can't be stressed while you're here. And they had these lawsuits well into the 1980s to preserve their push not to hire women. So like, we don't want to hire women as caretakers or like valets or anything. No women.
I'm really conflicted listening to this because I keep bouncing between this sounds awesome and these guys sound like douchebags. Like I don't know which side I'm on.
I couldn't agree more, Joe. As a man, as a white male, I couldn't agree more.
Let the three of us speak as white males. This sounds awesome.
I think I speak for all of the world when I say this sounds great.
I don't know. It's just, it's a strange thing because it feels like there are so many, the question is like the male only space or the women's only space or a space for black folks only. And the question is like, do those exist already?
Mm-hmm.
Should their existence be legally protected?
Not
and the thing is like, there are so many like good old boys clubs that exist kind of just like, they have to, they're like the court orders them to hire women. So like, oh, hey, how about you? Nope. You don't count. Back to hiring men. Like they can retain.
Yeah. You can skirt it pretty easily.
Yeah.
No pun intended. so this is, it's pretty interesting. This reminds me of like a Silicon Valley type escapade that I'm sure still. So this still goes on. Like this is still a place.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very till like it's still, if you guys are familiar with the name Alex Jones, InfoWars dude, back in 2000, apparently he infiltrated the Bohemian Grove, which is the grove where they...
I'm so happy he wasn't part of it. Like, I was so nervous you were going to say, he's in the club!
No. He infiltrated it with his cameraman, apparently, and he was expecting that... You remember the opening ceremony I told you about with the effigy of stress?
Mm-hmm.
He thought that was a ritual sacrifice to a Babylonian god. And so he recorded that and was like, we think we've got the liberal elite on camera
finally
sacrificing babies to Molech. And
here's Mark Zuckerberg eating people.
Yep. They all took off their masks and they are lizard people.
It was just a scarecrow they burned. Anyway, it's just a really weird thing. I'm sharing this with you guys because I had no idea it existed before doing the London research. And I love it. London is this proletarian dude. He's all about the working man.
Wait, is this the cabin by your house?
No. No, that's a different thing.
Did it burn down? So,
That's his ranch. I'll talk about his ranch in a minute. So this is the weird thing about Jack London. He champions the working man. He's like writing poems about how bad scabs are. But then also he belongs to this extremely elitist cultural group in San Francisco. And he bought this land out in Sonoma County, which you might know from like the Napa Sonoma region
in California.
California. Yeah. And so he wanted to build this like model farm agrarian society. And he built this incredibly expensive ranch house, and it cost what would be $2 million today.
Wow.
And he built this, and the farm was like a huge failure. So he's raking in all this money from writing, and he's spending it on this nonsense, this play acting of being a working man. And then the farm, the ranch burned down. He's like, nope, I'm done.
It's a play farm.
So now it's a state historical park in California. So it's weird. It's just a weird, weird.
Yeah, it's a great little fact, London.
Fact London.
It's a great fact, London.
Just like Joe's character Rivera is cool, I have a story about a cool guy who wants to get warm. That's my segue.
That's good.
Thank you.
I don't really didn't think it was needed, but I appreciate it.
It would work. To be perfectly frank with you, or without it. To be perfectly frank, I forgot I had written that down and just now remembered.
I read down my segues. You know it. I have a whole list of segues just pinned on the wall here. I'm just ready to use.
Grabbing them at random. Okay, so I'm going to say some things about this story, and I don't really need to explain the storyline anymore. Like he's a greenhorn. You guys know what that means?
I think you definitely need to explain the story more.
Okay. He's a greenhorn. Do you guys know what a greenhorn is?
No, I honestly don't.
He's wet it's behind the ears.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He's wet behind the ears. He's a dude. What the cowboys would call a dude. It's his first year. The story says this kind of grim line early in the story foreshadows. It says he was a newcomer in the land, and this was his first winter. And he's in the Yukon Territory, which is like north Canada, so it gets a little bit cold up there. And he sets out to walk across a infrequently traveled trail with a dog, and it is 75 degrees below zero.
So cold.
Which is extremely
That's
cold.
Unreal.
He talks about like he spits some water out of his mouth, and it freezes and crackles in the air and falls to the ground completely.
Yeah.
So, what is
the coldest you remember it being in Wisconsin?
I want to say a few years, actually kind of recently. So we get snow days. They're not snow days in Wisconsin. Litheads, this cold might blow your mind. We get days that school is canceled because the weather is too cold outside.
Right. The threshold that happens more commonly than snow.
Yep, more commonly than snow. The threshold is negative 35 degrees, and that's with wind chill. I want to say a couple of years ago, we hit almost negative 50 degrees with wind chill, and I can't remember colder than that. That's incredibly cold.
Yeah, you can't breathe.
No.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Physically
it hurts
painful
to breathe. And like everything is just instantly frozen. So I can't imagine double that almost.
No, double.
Well, and this guy, if you went out in that weather, especially for any length of time, you would like bundle up your face, especially. This guy goes out, and like I say, he's a greenhorn. He has what we call hubris. He has pride. He goes out. Do you think he covers his face? He does not.
He better. Oh, no.
He doesn't cover his
face.
Wait a minute.
He's a goner. Hey.
This is fiction.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. So he wrote this based on like Joe said, he like went to the Klondike, he went in the gold rush, he got $4.50 and some scurvy, came back, and he also had these experiences. This is based on stuff that happened to him in the Yukon. So stories he heard, people that he talked to, maybe he, I mean, he had to have experienced some of this extreme temperature. Like he, and I'm sure there are plenty of these stories out there. So yes, this is fiction, but it could very easily have happened.
Yeah.
Something similar probably did.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's out there. He's not, doesn't have his face covered. And, the story really boils down to, and so, sorry, let me finish telling you like what happens and then I'll tell you what it boils down to.
Okay.
So he's like walking in the snow and he knows that you shouldn't fall through the ice and get your feet wet because then you have to build a fire. And so he mostly avoids that, but then he does fall through and wet his feet.
Shit.
And then he has to build a fire. And I'm not going to tell you what happens, but whether or not he builds the fire. This is the whole point, though. And the whole, like, the beauty of this story is how it's so minute with its details. Like, London shows us, like, the struggle that this guy has to light a match. And what a Herculean effort this is to make a match catch fire. And we get like a creeping sense. It's almost like we are freezing along with this guy, a creeping sense of just like, we can't look away. We use this comparison a lot for stories and stuff. Like, yeah, it's like a car crash. You can't look away. But this is, you know, kind of where this is going and you can't look away. It's dreadful. It's dreadful. He's a moron. He talks to this old guy and the old guy is like, hey, don't go out in this. Stick to the trail. Cover your face. Stay here with me until it gets warmer.
So I have a question. This sounds oddly familiar and very similar to Call of the Wild. So does this guy write a lot about the wild? And if so, do all of his characters die in the end?
Well, I think pretty clearly, as with the Mexican, not all of them die in the end. And I'm really glad that we kind of have these two contrasts because London does do things that are not, not huge downers. He does write stories that are okay. And
is it a lot of man versus wilderness? I guess I'm not asking for like his entire catalog, like, but cause it sounds like he wrote quite a bit, but, he might be pretty good at this.
Yeah, he is good at this. It turns out he actually wrote, in doing research, I discovered that he wrote a bunch of stuff which we would call science fiction.
Yeah.
That's not about the wild. It's not about, he writes like a futuristic novel about like what happens if capitalism keeps going, I think. It's dystopian.
spoilers! No.
It's dystopian.
Oh, spoilers! You might lose this week.
What a shock. He also writes like, he writes stories about like various science fiction things. He has some kind of autobiographical novels that recount some of his own experience. So it's not all, you know, this man versus nature.
Hey, if you write 119 short stories, if you write, you know, if you write 22 novels, if you write 3 memoirs, etc., like you're going to write a little of everything by the time you're like, you can't just write about one thing.
Scattershot. So this is one of the big things about this novel. It is conflict boiled down to its purest form. It's efficient. It's powerful. It's man versus nature. None of these characters have names. It's not clear. Like he doesn't say, oh, it's this town. It's kind of generally clear. Like it's in the Yukon. You could probably figure out roughly where it is. But the point is, it's will the man survive? And it's really interesting the way that this conflict is presented because this story exists in two versions. There was an earlier version published in 1902 and then a later version published in 1908. And the stories differ pretty dramatically. The earlier story has a kind of a happy-ish ending, at least a positive ending. And the later story, it's like London went back to it and said, no, I'm going to make this more of a downer.
Why would he rewrite his own book that close?
I think the first one was published. I think the first one was published in a magazine for children.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. So the first one is a children's. It's published for children, and it's got kind of like a didactic like. Listen, you listen to your elders, and you don't go. But this is just
the ending different. And quick follow up question: was he always a fucking sellout?
Well, it's actually kind of the opposite of being a sellout, because he wrote something which could potentially have been very popular. He's like, no, I'm going to include more about a man whose hands are so cold that he can't feel his flesh burning.
You know what I love about this is there's a famous writing rule, and you guys have probably heard this before, which says if you're ever writing a scene and it just feels like it's dead, like it feels like there's no tension in the scene, put a gun on the table. Right? If you have two characters in the room talking and it's a boring conversation, put a gun on the table between them. Add tension to the scene. What I love about this is, like, here is a guy building a fire. What could be more mundane? But of course, when it's a matter of life or death, it's incredibly filled with tension.
Yeah, when there's an ice gun to his head.
An ice gun to his head.
A gun of ice.
A gun of ice. So I have one more question for you. So it's man versus nature, but like, what? And is that it? Is it just man versus nature? Is it somebody just surviving, or is he like learning something or encountering? Is there any character evolution here, or is it just literally like black and white? What's he trying to do?
He's
survive.
He is. Well, he doesn't set out to survive.
Sounds this like is he's not doing like, a bad fucking job. This sounds is like he should like turn around.
This is not like Bear Grylls out in the wildness trying to you know, shoot his television show or whatever. Mm-hmm. He's not trying to challenge himself. Pee. He's just trying to get from point A to point B. And he doesn't, he thinks, this is the thing, he thinks he is stronger than the wilderness.
Oh,
he thinks
that's hubris. A big mistake.
Hubris.
It's hubris, right. He goes into this thinking, I can do this. I'm going to be fine. I don't need, it's not that cold. I don't need a face covering. And he goes out, and it's not just like, oh, will his survival skills win out over the implacable power of nature? No, it's like, will this idiot get the thing which is coming to him? And you kind of think like, it's almost like a sandbox. It's almost like London is saying, what is stronger? Human's ability to use tools, fire nature. As a tool, or nature's ability to be unexpected and get you when you least yeah. see it coming.
Hey, spoiler alert, based on like nature, I think it's nature.
Yeah.
It's based really on powerful.
On the internet, I think Joe might be right.
Nature does have a pretty good.
He learns the hard way. I actually got one last question.
Please.
Is this better or worse than Call of the Wild?
I think so. I've read Call of the Wild.
One answer, one word answer. Better or worse?
Better.
Ooh, take that, Nick.
No, that's kind of what better. I was expecting, I think this, 'cause it's shorter.
Well, it is shorter, and I read an analysis which says that he is like meticulous with his use of language. And reading this story, it's almost like we talked about Hemingway's very short, kind of quick sentences. Mm-hmm. It's so well crafted that, like I say, or I guess like Joe said, he makes building a fire like the most stressful thing ever. Tell you what, Nick, are you gonna deliberate for a bit?
Yeah, I'd like to deliberate.
Yeah, so Joe, let's tell these people about some internet stuff they should do.
Hey,
so litheads.
Everybody's favorite
litheads. You've taken a lot from us, litheads. But now
we
is
do
the
this
time
for you.
When we it's time to pay your dues, lithead. Right? Like we need something.
Interesting
from you.
Approach. Interesting approach. I will say
litheads. This is the part of the podcast where we have the contract negotiations.
You've made it to the end, and now you owe us. That's and right. If you don't give us a 5-star review, we are going to break your legs.
Yes, we know where you live.
Nick, you're supposed to be deliberating.
Oh, sorry. I couldn't help but chime
Listen, Joe's done the bad cop, so I'll do the good cop. We love knowing that we're not just shouting into the void. And we also love sharing books with people. So if you enjoy the show, following or liking or doing whatever you need to do to get updates on the show through our various social media channels would be awesome. We also have a really snazzy website where you can submit a book that you'd like us to read. We just recently did one of these. Folks, if you have a book that you want to hear featured on the podcast, if you want one of us to do our level best to summarize it and then have Nick ignore most of what we say about it.
What's that? I heard my name. I wasn't sure what you're talking about.
Head over to the website and click the link and submit a book. We'd love to.
And that website is, of course, youdontknowlitpodcast.com. And one of the only things you can click on there is the button that says suggest a book, plus many social media tags. Well,
I mean, you can click on anything. It just won't do much.
Right.
Beyond.
Oh, yeah. You can click on anything.
Yeah, click around.
I'd like to hear more about the revolution.
Oh.
Viva la revolucion.
Viva la revolucion.
I have a request of you, Joe.
Yeah.
Could you read this either in Spanish or in a Sylvester Stallone accent?
I will not do either of those things, but your request has been noted.
It's my dying wish.
Registered. It's been. Oh.
I will echo everything that Joe reads as Sylvester Stallone.
Thank you. I'm going to read like three like short paragraphs so that that joke might get old really quick.
Oh, Nick, how about you summarize it afterwards in Sylvester Stallone's voice?
Sounds good.
Perfect. Okay.
Go for it, Joe.
So, as we talked about, Jack London was an avowed socialist his entire life. And this is a poem that he published called Ode to a Scab. A scab, of course, is somebody who crosses a picket line. And Jack London writes, "After God had finished the rattlesnake, the toad, and the vampire, he had some awful substance left with which he made a scab. A scab is a two-legged animal with a corkscrew soul, a waterlogged brain, and a combination backbone made of jelly and glue. Where others have hearts, he carries a tumor of rotten principles. When a scab comes down the street, men turn their back and angels weep in heaven and the devil shuts the gates of hell to keep him out. No man has the right to a scab as long as there's a pool of water deep enough to drown his body in or a rope long enough to hang his carcass with. Judas Iscariot was a gentleman compared with a scab. For betraying his master, he had character enough to hang himself. A scab hasn't. Esau sold his birthright for a mess of pottage. Judas Iscariot sold his savior for 30 pieces of silver. Benedict Arnold sold his country for a promise of a commission in the British Army. The modern strikebreaker sells his birthright, his country, his wife, his children, and his fellow men for an unfulfilled promise from his employer, trust, or corporation. Solidarity wins."
Thank you.